Welcome to Changemakers. I'm Michael Heyman, and today I'm joined by Angela Naef, the Chief Research and Development Officer at Reckitt, the global leader in hygiene, health, and nutrition, whose products touch the lives of billions of people every day. With an exceptional career in biotech and health sciences, Angela is at the forefront of Reckitt's mission to drive innovation that not only addresses today's health challenges, but shapes the future of healthier lives worldwide. This is the story of science shaping the future. And with it, we're going to explore how today's most influential scientists are not just advancing knowledge, but actively shaping the world around us. From everyday life to career trajectories and tackling some of the most urgent challenges facing our planet. Angela, welcome to Changemakers. Great pleasure to see you. I'm just thinking about how I introduce you. Chief Research and Development Officer at Reckitt, Six Sigma Black Belt holder, Mensa, UC Davis PhD. I mean, the list goes on. I feel almost underqualified to introduce you, but I was thinking about what would I describe your career as? And you said, it's all about tomorrow. Where is the next thing coming from? Where will the next change be? Does that bring it all together? Is that what a Mensa student gets?
I love that. You know what the image I just had as you were saying that was this idea around seeing around the next corner. Mm. You're right. So thank you very much for your very kind words. But it's actually my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a great biography, great CV. I mean, and also it takes you into this role of science shaping the future. Mm. And this idea that I guess, you know, when I was growing up, it was science fiction. Now it's becoming like science fact. And I guess it's because of people like you that are commercializing science, actually taking it into our lives in a very real way, outside the movies. Mm. I mean, yeah. What got you? I mean, I know your background has been, you know, very much sort of well told in the media, but it does start from a very personal story, doesn't it? Mm. In terms of, I think you were given a little red microscope.
Nope.
So let's go back to that starting point in terms of actually that first moment of thinking, actually, science might be for me.
Oh, wow. Oh, I know. Little girl Angela, right? That's right. Who I think of. I can see her in my mind.
How old were you?
I think I was about 8 or 9. There was a series of little events around that kind of formative years for me that I think now, of course, in hindsight, I can appreciate them and mm-hmm. I can reflect on them. But your point around the little red microscope, I actually, I was given this red microscope from my parents for a holiday gift. Yeah. And it was one of those moments where, you know, you're opening everything up and it's exciting and it's, you know, Christmas morning and everything. And I had this little red microscope and all I could think about was what was I going to look at.
Do you remember what you did look at? Do you remember what the first thing you saw in that moment?
I looked at everything. I can remember little things like you go outside, you get the grass, you get the insects, you get the things, you get the pluck of hair from, you know, sister's head. You get the things in the kitchen, right?
And those little glass.
The little glass slides.
Amazing, right? Yeah. I mean, I remember that in my kind of like early days when I first got a microscope. Okay. And I like that's sort of like the magnification was mind-blowing.
What color was your microscope?
I don't think it was as interesting as red. I think it was a pretty standard microscope. But I just remember being able to move the sort of the various magnifying sort of pieces around on the circle there.
Yeah, and you're like 1x, 2x, 10x.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's mind-blowing. But it, did that sort of like, was so that tell us what that inspired in terms of, I suppose, the wonderment that you were able to see.
Yeah, I think it must have crystallized something in my parents' minds, actually.
Right.
Right. And so if I think back now as a parent, right, that they must have seen something in me that was, you know, sort of seeking those kinds of experiences.
Did they have a science background themselves?
Yeah. So my dad is an aeronautical engineer. Mm-hmm. So truly like a rocket scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my mom after she had 4 girls, went back to nursing school.
Mm.
So in her own story, she made her new life as a nursing student, you know, with us as little kids, and then made a career in science and nursing.
And when you think about back then, I guess, you know, role models for girls in science would have been a lot fewer than they are today, right? Mm. In terms of actually how you sustained that, was it the family background that kept it going, or were there other influences that kind of I suppose sustained you?
Yeah, I think it was all of the above, right? So, I mean, the first thing, your parents, right? Your parents are so important in your formative years on the things you get exposed to, right? The things that you, that, you know, get put in front of you. But I can remember being sent to, like, science camp.
Right.
Maybe I was 12.
Yeah.
Right? And having the experience, although I don't remember any women there, really, but I remember the moment quite vividly. And then you sort of fast forward through your high school years and you're taking your mathematics and your chemistries and so forth. But when I got to university, I looked around and I was finally aware, you know, as a young woman, right, growing, like, where are all the women?
Yeah. You're unusual in this.
Yeah. I was aware of it.
Right. But, and I suppose in terms of how you felt about that, it obviously didn't stop you. Obviously, you kept with it, you kept going. And was it difficult being in that kind of male-dominated environment for you? Or how did it actually manifest itself in terms of the experiences that you had and actually what you took away from, I suppose, sort of concluding sciences for me?
Yeah. I think it's... a bit of it is conscious and a bit is subconscious, right? So I was aware, but not deterred.
Yeah.
I was cognizant, but not weakened. Mm. Like, that's how I, you know, and again, it's all in hindsight how I must have been feeling at the time, because I don't remember a point where I pulled back.
Yeah.
I don't remember a point where I said, well, I don't belong here.
Yeah.
So I definitely had that sense that, well, I feel different, right?
Yeah.
And I may need to think about that. And I'm sure I can recall having moments where I felt that I needed to conform.
Yeah.
Because I was different. Not because I was any one thing, because I was different in lots of ways, right? So that idea of sort of conforming to fit became a thing that I know that I did. And 10, 20, 30 years later, what I tell young students, young women today is, don't worry about conforming.
Yeah.
Be you.
But I guess not conforming is part of the scientific tradition, isn't it? Because if you're going to break boundaries, you've got to disrupt established thinking. You've got to think differently about the world and how you might be able to alter it.
Absolutely. And it becomes so fact-based. And, you know, scientists don't deal in opinions.
Yeah.
We deal in facts and data and thoughts and hypotheses and things you can test. So being able to lead with that was also very powerful as a young scientist, because it sort of helped you. It helped you get into the one conversation.
Right. But in reading your story, Angela, it does feel, though, that on the one hand, there is science, there is data, there is innovation, but there is also creativity and imagination and things that you might not expect to identify with a scientist's CV. So where does that sort of tradition, that impetus come from in you, do you think?
I think scientists are some of the world's most creative people.
Right.
I don't think of science and creativity as being separate.
Mm.
I actually think they're one and the same. Like, when you're asking a question around the art of the possible, what does that actually mean? Did we sit around and think, you know, I'm definitely going to make a supercomputer. That's what I'm going to do today. No, we asked the question around, what would make it possible to be able to do computations that much faster? Ah, let's think about solutions. So I think that's the...
But I suppose to those of us that aren't scientists, you think about scientists as calculations. You think about scientists as doing things that are highly rational. And yet I was listening to Brian Cox just a few weeks ago talking to school children. And I realized that actually his greatest gift is that he's a storyteller, is that he explained the story of black holes to me in a way that I was just like, well, to me and 500 others, in a way that was just like, well, first of all, it could have been one-on-one because he was that good. But secondly, that actually really good, really brilliant scientists seem to understand how to narrate and tell a story about why what they're doing matters, about where it might take you. I mean, do you see storytelling as a part of what you're doing?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
How's that manifest?
Yeah, I think, I'll take you to an experience I recently had. So I was at one of our lab facilities around the world, and we hosted a bunch of school-age children. Mm. So you walk into this room, and there's, you know, 28-year-old boys and girls, and they're all thinking about what's the possibilities that we might have in there. And to stand in front of a group like that, where they're just looking at you, just ready to absorb anything, And that moment where you realize the great responsibility that you have to capture.
And you're having your magic medicine lollipops.
Yes. Yes! How did you read about that
I certainly did. Yes. Tell us about those.
Oh my gosh. It's so, but this is where this beauty of the undeterred mind mind just gets you in all sorts of places. So we had this competition where we hosted these students, and we asked them, of all the things that you can see that we do today at Reckitt, what do you think we should work out next?
Yeah.
It's very simple.
And the lollipops was the answer.
And the lollipops was great. And they made little art stories around it. And it was all about a medicated lollipop with different flavors and different colors. And they brought the whole thing to life.
Amazing.
Right? Yeah. And it was a really good experience.
Bring us to today. You know, I mean, you know, people may not know Reckitt, but they will certainly know the products of Reckitt in terms of, you know, Gaviscon, Nurofen, Vanish, Dettol. I mean, it felt like looking into my kitchen cupboard, actually, in terms of actually the kind, I suppose, the consumer goods that you are, you know, that every day are part of everybody's lives. In terms of the kind of how that fits into this wider, I suppose, mission, this wider sense of journey for the business, tell us a little bit about that. And I suppose how that kind of science and innovation background makes a difference to that story.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we are in your medicine cabinet underneath your sinks, right? And sort of everywhere in between. So the way I think about it is we are a company whose job it is to make the lives of our consumers better.
Mm.
That's the goal, right? Is to make the job, you know, so make our consumers experience life in the best possible way. And so whether or not it's cleaning your home so that you're free of germs and things that, you know, make us sick, like that's a great thing. Get on with your day, right?
Yeah.
Or the medicines that help you deal with a cough or a cold, right? Get to work, get to school. And so that spirit of consumer is what sits at the heart of what we do. And so it's about this consumer experience. It's about their needs. But the job as a scientist is that translation.
Yeah. I was just thinking, how does that work? Because it sounds to me like you're like, you know, the equivalent of Q in a James Bond film, right? You know, you're coming up with all these kind of like ideas that are going to sort of shape the way we deal with headaches or the way we're going to clean our kitchens or all these sorts of areas. I mean, how does that kind of journey from the consumer to innovation start? Is it circular? Is it linear? Are you sort of second guessing what the products might be, or actually does the consumer help you in terms of that understanding, I guess, in terms of what you're going to be designing for the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. It is not a linear path, right? It's very circuitous.
Right.
I love to think about this never-ending loop, right? So it's all about, what do you understand from a consumer? How does that translate into possible solutions you could bring to them? How do you turn that into a product that you can actually get to the consumer? And then how do you launch it and then get that feedback all the way back and continue? So we never stop.
Mm.
We never stop with the thing or the launch, right? Did it do what it was intended to do?
Hmm.
Did the consumer actually experience it in the way that we designed it to do? And the shorter answer is it's never perfect. And it's never the way you think it's going
to
be.
Is there a, if you think back to some of, like, I suppose, greatest hits, things that you're most proud about in terms of the science and innovation piece within the business, is there a kind of formula for what gets it right for the consumer?
Oh, that's a really, really important question. I think it's about thinking about what is the consumer saying, what are they not saying, and how do you translate that into a kind of a job to be done, a service or a product and so forth. And it's that iteration loop. So the way I think about it, what I think is the way to do this right, is to create sort of a virtual table. You create this virtual table where all the experts that you have within your company, so within Reckitt, sit around this virtual table with the consumer in the middle of the table. What is she saying? What is she asking for? And it's the marketer that's listening for certain things. And it's the product formulator that then is translating that need into potential design element to the manufacturing team, to the sales team, and all the way around so that it's that holistic, inclusive innovation that I think is the magic.
And yet the question then, I suppose, is how does the scientist's voice get heard within that wider, I suppose, C-suite sort of like environment? I mean, I was reading an interesting Times raconteur piece thought about you, and it said, you know, the first paragraph says, take a look through the roles on the executive boards of some of the world's biggest companies, and you'll see many of the same titles. All have CEOs, most have CFOs, several have CMOs, but the less common one is the chief research and development officer. So in terms of actually that, the diversity of thought that you provide, the diversity of experience and innovation. Tell us about actually how that translates as a superpower for the business in terms of what can it do by having something in the mix that other companies might not have.
Yeah, I think it's all the voices. I think Reckitt has been very purposeful in saying the diversity of the thought, the experiences, and the expertise matters. All of it, right? We need to have excellence in all the different things that make our business work. And we're a consumer goods company. What we do is create solutions. And who is sitting at the heart of making sure that all that insights turns into product on shelf is your technical team.
I read a great Walt Whitman quote where which I thought might speak to you. He said, be curious, not judgmental. Do you like that one?
Yes.
But it's, well, for Ted Lasso
fans. I was just going to say Ted Lasso too. He and I together both, we appreciate a good Walt Whitman quote.
But when I was thinking about that quote, I was thinking that has got to be what a good scientist does, doesn't it?
That's right.
I mean, you've got to have that sense of curiosity, not judgment, being sort of, I mean, but I suppose when you face judgment and you face a lack of, you know, because there are reasons why all sorts of organizations might be less curious. They might have a pressure to deliver in all sorts of different, it could be all sorts of, I suppose, operational requirements, why the status quo sort of like has to prevail. How do you make sure that curiosity finds its place in terms of the things that actually, right now, we might not even have a P&L for this item, but it could be where the future actually is going to sort of reveal itself?
So yeah, be curious every day. That is the thing that is running through my mind all the time, because it forces you to ask questions. It forces you not to maybe sort of anticipate the answer or know the answer. It forces you to ask questions.
Yeah.
And I think when we all ask questions, we learn more. And every single time we learn more, we get that much closer to something that is going to be more valuable.
I mean, you've chosen to build your career in the service of consumers. But presumably when you were at UC Davis and you were actually studying for your PhD, there were other avenues that you could have gone down with science and where it might have taken you. What drives the interest in terms of working with a brand which is all about, I suppose, the consumer, people, everyday society?
Yeah. So you're right. There's always forks in the road. We all have them, right?
Yeah.
And I can remember when I was finishing my graduate studies, there's always the big question, do you go to academia or do you go into industry?
Yeah.
That's always the big question, right? And I will actually refer to my father in this one. So my father was, as I mentioned before, an aeronautical engineer. He was an entrepreneur in his own right. And I think what he taught me was there was huge value in the ability to translate the science, the engineering, the technology into outcomes that matter for people. And you can do that in a business context and have more reach.
Right.
And ultimately have more impact. Doing the one is great, and we need lots of smart people doing the one.
It's quite interesting on that, because there are people in like environmental science that, you know, they've gone through this thing of, you know, why would I try and do this for a business, not an NGO? If I want to say, if I want to change the world, if I want the world to be a better place, it sounds to me like you found answers in business that, you know, another version of yourself might have found in academia or working in a research institute. In terms of what has business sort of changed the scientists? I mean, I know how we've talked a little bit about how science changes business, but how does business change your outlook?
No, I think that's a really interesting question. Let me think. I think that the ability to get to consumers and the ability to have reach makes it worth it. So this idea around how are you actually going to create the value and amplify it and let it travel on its own. And I think the world of business allows you to do that with a mindset of we want to do good. We want to do good for consumers, for the planet, for the company. And all of those things can actually be true at the same time.
Right.
And I think that's pretty compelling.
Does the profit motive change anything, that actually a business is about, ultimately, it's got to be successful. I mean, how does that marry up with the kind of, I suppose, running a lab, running an innovation platform where actually you are pursuing innovative ideas that may not even have a P&L yet?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the way that we do it is we think about our investment strategies. We think about the brands that are important to us in terms of the growth trajectory. And we make sure that we've got investment thesis and profiles and all the things that you have. So we've got projects and programs and we do milestone-based planning, everything you would imagine we do, right? To be able to deliver against the business objectives. So it's in service of ultimately making sure that our consumers are getting what they need, which translates into good business.
Right. And how about the team ethos that you have to develop? Because I was actually thinking when I was reading my notes that I remember interviewing a guy called Martin McCaw. He was the CEO of Dyson. And he talks about this thing where he went into Dyson's sort of like major sort of like factory, and he found all of these kind of heaters that were basically running a balloon around a thousands of square foot sort of thing. And they said, we can push this whole balloon around. And his first response was, what's that got to do with my business? What he found was that actually these were scientists that were using fun and they were using creativity, but they were also creating new boundaries for the technology, which they then went on to develop. I mean, do you have to create that kind of, I mean, do you create a fun environment? How do you do that in terms of what's the mix in terms of getting the best out of people?
Yeah, I think science is super fun. And it's the world's biggest playground, right? So, I mean, if you go into a lab, which I love to go into a lab, it's like all of my, you know, my neurons start firing, right?
What's your favorite bit?
Oh my God, I just love every part of it, right? It's just, to me, it's where the magic happens. It's where the world moves, right? And so the way we talk about it at Reckitt is absolutely consumers at the heart. We've got to have good business. We've got to be diligent. We've got to be prudent. You have to be that as part of a large corporation. But we know that our job is to drive leading edge solutions. And we say it. And in order to be leading edge, you can't stop.
Right.
And so this feeling of, you know, learning, failing, iterating is how we bring the culture to bear, right? So there are some that will say, if you never fail, you're just simply not pushing hard enough. And that's a failure in and of itself. So that's how we try to think about mindset and culture and the sense of nothing is punitive. Science shouldn't be punitive. It should be around progress and moving it forward and making sure that we've learned and learned and learned and learned.
And the pursuit of the better tomorrow. Right?
That's exactly right.
I mean, I suppose, you know, you've talked about collaborative and purpose-driven teams. I mean, is that purpose? I mean, I think about a lot of scientists, they love things like, they love science fiction. They love, you know, there's a lot of this thing about this idea that we're going for a better place, perhaps, than we are in today. I mean, is that realistic? Is that the kind of scientific environment that you would relate to?
Absolutely, because I think it's also our responsibility. I think it's our opportunity, and I think it's our responsibility as scientific professionals. Like sustainability. We can talk about sustainability for a little bit, right? That sense of, you know, the industrialization of so many processes has created some of the issue that we're in today, right? And so as the, you know, modern scientific community is like, well, then the job is to tackle it at its heart, right? Find the new ways to do tomorrow so that we don't have to deal with the
I think this is, you know, this is a view that often doesn't get aired in the media, is the kind of the more optimistic, positive view about what science, innovation, technological process can deliver. Because, you know, we look at issues like environment, sustainability, we look at many of the world's most difficult problems. Historically, our innovators and technologists have always had answers, and I suppose that's behind how we define progress. When you look at the sort of the landscape today, and you look at the variety of things that we're facing, I guess, as a species, as people, and living on this planet, do you remain optimistic, I guess, in terms of our ability to solve these big challenging problems? And I suppose the role that business will have this time, not just government, in actually stepping up to the plate and making sure it happens.
Absolutely. I'm very optimistic. I really am.
Why? What drives that?
Well, I think that the advancements that we can look back on should give us all of the right to win, if you will, looking forward. Look at what we've done the last 100, 200, 300 years, actually. I mean, you go back through lots of different creation of processes, creation of new products, creation of medicines and farm practices. I mean, it's lots of things that allows our modern society to be what it is today. Mm-hmm. So for me, I look back and I think, what an amazing time to be in the position I'm in right now.
Yeah.
Because the pace of play, never been faster, right? Mm-hmm. Never been more progressive. You know, the logarithmic and exponential things that are happening
around
the world.
Does it amaze you?
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, you know, because this sort of, I remember going to a lecture a few years ago about the kind of the singularity and this moment where technology would cross over our own ability to change things. And it suddenly feels like it's becoming real, isn't it? In terms of the rise of AI, the rise of all of these different things. How does that change the kind of like the scientific landscape for you on a day-by-day basis?
Yeah, I think tools and approaches and so forth, we have to keep up with them, right? And what we're living in today, like you mentioned, Gen AI, right? So I have a very large program within Reckitt in terms of really exploiting the opportunities for Gen AI from everything from driving stronger productivity, as you can imagine, right? Just doing, you know, things smarter, to thinking about things we've never been able to think about before.
Yeah.
You know, so connecting data in totally new ways, where maybe in two dimension or three dimensions, we just can't see it as humans, but machines can.
And yet, with all of these incredible advances and changes, one of the points you've made is that STEM in Europe is still struggling to attract, especially girls, and actually even as an educational sort of area of endeavor is kind of like, How do you address that? How do you excite the world about the possibilities of basically a career in the future?
Yeah. So it's going exactly and talking with those students, showing them what it feels like, showing them the passion, the creativity, the what you could possibly do.
What puts them off, do you think?
I think there's a lack of role models. Mm-hmm. I think our education system doesn't teach in a very diverse way, right? It's a little bit monolithic in certain ways, right? Where it's like one way to do it. But we know people learn differently. Mm. Girls, boys, just by definition, I mean, they learn differently.
Yeah.
And so being able to put things into a context that would be resonant requires additional effort.
Do you think enough business leaders get the fact that actually, if you want diversity of product, if you want diversity of outcome, you need diversity of inputs, you need diversity of people, you need diversity, you know, whether it comes to sex, creed, you know, all the key things give you better scientists, give you better outcomes. Do you think people get it now, or do you think it's still just a sort of, you know, a point that is discussed rather than acted upon?
I think there's a large gradient still. Yeah. I think there are real places where the difference is manifested, right? So at Reckitt, we've got a diversity council and we talk about things and we bring all the things to the table. But it comes to when we're making those critical decisions, do you really have all the voices around the table? And we ask ourselves that question, do we? Even before we sort of assess it and think, well, what was that answer okay with everybody, right? We'll make sure before we get to that point that all the voices are around the table. So I think being purposeful in that way is a step forward.
Who inspires you today?
Oh, lots of people inspire me. Oh. Anybody that I can learn from inspires me. I love that sense of, you know, we talked about be curious, right? So I love that sense of asking questions and learning and building and so forth. The people around me, my team. I was actually at one of our facilities a couple of days ago in Poland and sitting with that group of people talking about measurement sciences and all sorts of very technical things. It was so rewarding and so inspiring and so much fun.
And last question. I mean, if I could wave a magic wand and allow you to talk to the young girl that received the red microscope, but you could have a message that was with that present, what's the message you'd send yourself?
I think it's you can do it. That just find that inner strength, find that inner power, be authentic and go for it.
Angela, that's as good a place to leave it as any. You can go for it. You can solve the biggest problems. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you for joining me on Changemakers.
Thank you so much, Michael.